morning front pages. For the next hour, Chris will bring you the front page news from the morning newspapers, the latest headlines from around the state and around the rest of the world.
Hey, July 11th, I'm Lodi Avola, and I'll be reading to you today from the front pages of the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. And we'll begin, as we always do, with a description of the pictures on the headline pages of both newspapers. The New York Times, this goes with our top story. It's a photograph of Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, who visited Capitol Hill on Wednesday. And he is standing between two congressmen and obviously having a discussion, but it looks to be pretty friendly. And then another story that we'll be having this morning is on women in Olympics. There are three black and white photographs. The first women's Olympics, there are two photographs having to do with that. The first one shows two women crossing the finish line in obviously a race. And then another photograph showing a group of women marching behind the United States flag. And this, and then a third small photograph of Alice Milliot, who organized the first Women's Olympics in 1922. And we will have that story. And then another story that we'll be doing is on Alec Baldwin. And this photograph, a colored photograph, shows him sitting at a table looking down as his wife has her hand on his cheek, talking to him, bent over talking to him. That's the New York Times. And then on the cover of the Hartford Courant, we have another photograph to go with a story that we'll be doing. It shows Stefan Byrne, a young man who has Angelman syndrome, and he's sitting with his parents. They're all smiling. They're sitting in the Bushnell Theater. And then two giant photographs in the center of the page. We do not have a story to go with that, but the title of the photograph is Wind Resolution, and it says future wind power arrived by sea Wednesday in Connecticut, and it shows turbine nacelles arriving by cargo ship on Wednesday at the State Pier in New London, and it shows giant turbines being installed. And then another photograph, actually we have a story relating to this in the Times this morning, but it shows President Joe Biden standing among at least a dozen NATO leaders. And he is central, and in this photograph at least, he is speaking. And those are our photographs on the Hartford Courant. So we will now go to our top story in the New York Times. NATO is offering Ukraine a path to membership. The United States and its NATO allies have agreed that Ukraine should have an irreversible path to membership, and that irreversible is in quotes, in the alliance, enshrining the phrase in a document that was released on Wednesday during the alliance's summit in Washington. While there is no consensus yet about Ukraine joining NATO, the strengthened language shows that there is movement in that direction. The United States was once deeply skeptical about whether Ukraine was ready to become a member, and while questions remain, more and more American and European officials believe that the country will eventually be able to join. Ukraine's future is in NATO, members said in a communique, adding that, quote, we will continue to support it on its irreversible path to full Euro-Atlantic integration, including NATO membership. End quote. The document does not lay out an exact timeline for membership, which the Ukrainians have wanted, but it says the Allies will continue to support Ukraine's progress on, quote, democratic and security sector reforms, end quote. U.S. and Allied officials negotiated the commitments to Ukraine with new urgency, given the uncertainty over whether President Biden, a staunch opponent of Russia in its war in Ukraine, can win re-election this fall, according to officials in Washington. The officials had said it was critical that leaders of the 32 member nations who gathered in Washington this week used strong language to signal that Ukraine has a viable path to joining the alliance, even if it does not happen immediately because of the war. They also said the leaders must agree to concrete steps to ensure the alliance, rather than the United States, is the main organizer of military and humanitarian aid to Ukraine. Looming over the conversations is the specter of a second Donald J. Trump presidency. Mr. Trump has expressed admiration for President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia, criticized Ukraine, and expressed doubts about sending any additional U.S. military aid to the nation. And in his first term, Mr. Trump talked about withdrawing the United States from NATO. Because of those concerns, officials and analysts said that Trump-proofing, and that's in quotes, the alliance and aid to Ukraine was an important element of the talks this week. Ukraine can and will stop Putin, especially with our full collective support, Mr. Biden said in a speech on Tuesday night. Beyond solidifying foundations that could endure into a Trump presidency, the leaders are also trying to head off criticism from President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, who last year accused the alliance of waffling on a promise to give his country membership. Next article, Biden angling to make time his best ally. President Biden's resistance to pressure to end his re-election bid appears to be a strategy aimed at running out the clock, a play to leave his party so little time to come up with another candidate that his opponents stand down. Every day that Mr. Biden defies pressure to step aside, the prospects and logistics of replacing him become more untenable and riskier. And the potential of weeks of Democratic infighting as a united Republican Party nominates former President Donald J. Trump may start to look worse than rallying behind Mr. Biden, no matter the concerns about the 81-year-old president's health and ability to defeat Mr. Trump. It's a mess, said James Carville, a consultant who has been among a roster of Democrats pushing for Mr. Biden to step aside and clear the way for a new nominee. Suppose he gets what he wants. Everybody gets exhausted and just says, it's too much trouble. Mr. Biden's efforts to dig in were showing signs of initial success. On Tuesday, some Democratic leaders in Congress expressed support for the president and said it was time to move on. The urgent need right now is for Democrats to stick together and focus on the danger of Trump and his extremist agenda, said Representative Diana DeGetti of Colorado. If we do that, we will win. The calendar is on Mr. Biden's side. In the coming days, attention will turn to Mr. Trump, who is expected to name a running mate before his party gathers next week in Milwaukee to nominate him for a second term. Mr. Biden will be somewhat out of the public spotlight, focusing on the behind-the-scenes campaign to keep nervous Democrats in line. There are 35 days between July 18th, when Mr. Trump is set to accept his party's nomination in Milwaukee, and August 22nd, when Mr. Biden is set to accept his party's nomination in Chicago. But the Biden campaign, working with the Democratic National Committee, appears ready to compress the calendar even further. The party is planning a virtual roll call vote weeks before the convention is gaveled to order on August 19th. A move that appears meant to leave little to no doubt about who will be on top of the Democratic ticket this November. None of this is binding. The party sets the rules, and the party can change the rules. And Mr. Biden, for all his talk this week of sticking in the race, could change his mind, particularly if another bout of discouraging polls or another performance like the one he had in his debate with Mr. Trump shakes the party's confidence and encourages more Democratic defections. Mr. Biden's show of defiance, portraying himself as standing up against elites, even as polling suggests that most voters believe he is too old to run, may be an act of self-preservation. And here's our story with the black and white photo, Olympic photos. Women in Olympics, from improper, that's in quotes, to integral. It was 1922, 2 years before the last time the Olympics were held in Paris. On a warm August day, about 20,000 people came to Pershing Stadium to watch 77 athletes in track and field, including a team from the United States. There was a parade of nations. There were world records. There were 27 journalists and news coverage around the world. And at the start, a 38-year-old woman named Alice Milliat welcomed the world to Paris. She was the founder of the International Women's Sports Federation, known in her native France as the Fédération Sportive Féminine Internationale. Every competitor that day was a woman. "I hereby declare the first female Olympic Games open," she said. Milliat was making a statement that echoes today. The male-dominated world of the mainline Olympics, busy preparing for the Paris Games of 1924, ignored the 1922 event, other than to complain about Milliat's unauthorized use of the word Olympics. They dismissed the rising idea that women should compete at all. The 1924 Paris Games had a smattering of female athletes, 135 out of 3,089 competitors, but the Olympics hardly welcomed their participation beyond just a few events, such as swimming and tennis. There were no women competitions in most sports, including track and field, soccer, rowing, cycling, and even gymnastics. Pierre de Coubertin, the founder and leader of the modern Olympics, made his attitude known repeatedly over the years. "Having women in the Olympics," he said in 1912, "is impractical, uninteresting, ungainly, and I do not hesitate to add, improper." By 1928, his thoughts had not evolved. "As to the admission of women to the Games, I remain strongly against it," he said that year. He died in 1937 and has been heralded as a visionary of sport. But in the end, well, 2024, Milliat won the fight over gender. This summer's Olympics are expected to be the first with as many female athletes as male ones. Milliat, 100 years after the last Paris Olympics, is finally getting recognition as a pioneer, Billie Jean King of sorts for her age. Biographies are being published in France. A new documentary has been shown in theaters and on television. France's National Sports Museum in Nice has a temporary exhibition highlighting Milliat. Insurers deny care, and AI seeks remedy. At his rehabilitation medicine practice in Illinois, Dr. Aslan Tariq typically spent 7 hours a week fighting with insurance companies reluctant to pay for his patients' treatments. He often lost. There was the 45-year-old man who spent 5 months in a wheelchair while his insurer denied appeal after appeal for a prosthetic leg. Or the stroke survivor who was rehospitalized following a fall after his insurer determined his rehab, quote, could be done at home, end quote. Over the course of Dr. Tariq's 12-year career, these stories had become more common. The list of treatments that needed pre-approval from insurers seemed ever broadening, and the denials seemed ever rising. So in an effort to spare his patients what he deemed subpar care and himself mountains of paperwork, Dr. Tariq recently turned to an unlikely tool, generative AI. For a growing number of doctors, AI chatbots, which can draft letters to insurers in seconds, are opening up a new front in the battle to approve costly claims, accomplishing in minutes what years of advocacy and attempts at healthcare reform have not. We haven't had legislative tools or policy-making tools or anything to fight back, Dr. Tariq said. This is finally a tool I can use to fight back. Doctors are turning to the technology even as some of the company's largest, the country's largest insurance companies face class action lawsuits alleging that they used their own technology to swiftly deny large batches of claims and cut off seriously ill patients from rehabilitation treatment. Some experts fear that the prior authorization process will soon devolve into an AI arms race, and that's in quotes, in which bots battle bots over insurance coverage. Among doctors, there are few things as universally hated. If you want to see a physician go apoplectic at a cocktail party, mention prior authorizations, said Dr. Robert Wachter, the chair of the medicine department at the University of California, San Francisco. The process was designed by insurance companies to keep healthcare costs down by reining in doctors' use of unnecessary and expensive treatments. Baldwin called reckless, and that's in quotes, on set as trial for manslaughter opens. Prosecutors painted Alec Baldwin as a headstrong actor who repeatedly shirked his duty to maintain gun safety on the set of his film, leading to the shooting death of its cinematographer. The defense argued that it was a tragic accident, that's in quotes, and that Mr. Baldwin had no reason to believe that there was live ammunition in his gun or anywhere on the set of the Western Rust. More than 2 years and 8 months after the gun he was rehearsing with fired a fatal bullet, Mr. Baldwin found himself in a New Mexico courthouse on Wednesday, standing trial on a charge of involuntary manslaughter. If convicted, he faces up to 18 months in prison. The case is being closely watched by Hollywood, and not just because of the star at the center of it, famous for many movie and TV roles, including 30 Rock and Saturday Night Live. The question of an actor's liability has weighed over the case since the beginning. SAG-AFTRA, that's all in caps, the union representing film and television workers, has argued that gun safety on sets is the responsibility of qualified professionals, not performers. Erlinda O. Johnson, one of the prosecutors, told the jury in her opening statement that Mr. Baldwin should be held criminally responsible for the death of Halina Hutchins, the Rust cinematographer, because he had failed to take part in safety checks that day to see whether his gun contained a live round, and because he used the weapon in a reckless fashion. He pointed the gun at another human being, cocked the hammer, and pulled that trigger in reckless disregard for Ms. Hutchins' safety, she said in the Santa Fe County District Courthouse. One of Mr. Baldwin's defense lawyers, Alex Spiro, argued that the actor could not be found guilty of involuntary manslaughter because it was unthinkable for live ammunition to be loaded into a gun that was being used as a prop on the set of a movie. He said Mr. Baldwin had been told that day that the gun was cold, that's in quotes, which he said communicated to the whole production that there's nothing in the gun that can hurt anybody. Cold guns can't hurt people, Mr. Spiro said. It's impossible, literally impossible. Mr. Spiro faulted the crew members who were supposed to oversee gun safety on the set, the film's armorer and its first assistant director. The armorer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, was convicted this year of involuntary manslaughter for loading a live round into the gun and sentenced to 18 months in prison. The first assistant director, Dave Halls, has admitted to failing to thoroughly check the revolver and agreed to a plea deal on a charge of negligent use of a deadly weapon, avoiding prison time.
If you have the Amazon Echo or Google Home, you can listen to Chris on TuneIn.
today's weather forecast, local weather forecast. For today, scattered showers, cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny with a high near 91. South wind, 9 to 5 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 30%. For tonight, partly cloudy with a low around 69. South wind, 6 to 11 miles per hour, becoming light after midnight. Friday, a chance of showers with thunderstorms, mostly sunny with a high near 88. Chance of precipitation, 30%. For Friday night, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, actually a chance of precipitation, 70%. Mostly cloudy with a low around 71. Saturday, showers and possibly a thunderstorm, high near 84. Chance of precipitation, 80%. And Saturday night, partly cloudy with a low around 69. Now we'll have some stories from the business section of the New York Times. Tariffs target steel routed via Mexico. The Biden administration took steps on Wednesday to prevent China from circumventing American tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum by routing these imports through Mexico. The administration said it would impose tariffs on imports of Mexican metals that are partially made in China. American officials said the move would close a trade loophole that has allowed cheap state-subsidized Chinese metals to circumvent existing U.S. tariffs. The United States will now impose a 25% tariff on Mexican steel that is melted or poured outside of North America before being turned into a finished product. Previously, that steel would have entered the country duty-free. Mexican aluminum coming into the United States will face a tariff of 10% if it contains metal that has been smelted or cast in China, Belarus, Iran, or Russia, said Lael Brainard, the director of the White House's National Economic Council. Mexico, which recently increased its own tariffs on steel and aluminum from certain countries, will require importers to provide more information about where their steel products come from, the announcement said. The changes will take effect immediately. Officials in the Biden administration said the United States wanted to protect American factories that produce steel and aluminum, including those that have recently received new investments from government funds. Amazon says it reached climate goal. Amazon announced on Wednesday that effectively all of the electricity its operations used last year came from sources that did not produce greenhouse gas emissions. But some experts have criticized the method the company uses to make that determination as being too lenient. In its announcement, Amazon said it had reached its goal of 100% clean energy 7 years ahead of schedule. The company said it invested billions of dollars in more than 500 solar and wind projects to achieve its target. The energy generated by those projects is equivalent to the electricity consumed by the company's data centers, corporate buildings, grocery stores, and fulfillment centers in 27 countries. But because the solar and wind farms do not all directly power Amazon's operations, most of that energy is sent to electricity grids that serve many businesses and homes. Some critics say that the company's calculations can create a misleading impression of its effect on the climate. The clean energy projects Amazon has invested in can produce enough electricity to power the equivalent of 7.6 million U.S. homes, the company said. Amazon aims to reach net zero carbon emissions from all of its operations, including its delivery vans, planes, and other means of transportation, by 2040. We're really excited about, obviously, the goal that we set 5 years ago and reaching it 7 years early, said Kara Hurst, Vice President of Worldwide Sustainability at Amazon. That's quite an achievement for us. U.S. and allies take aim at Russian disinformation. The Justice Department said on Tuesday that it had moved to disrupt a covert Russian influence operation that used artificial intelligence to spread propaganda in the United States, Europe, and Israel with the goal of undermining support for Ukraine and stoking international political divisions. Working with the governments of Canada and the Netherlands, as well as officials at Elon Musk's social media platform X, the department said it seized two internet domains in the United States and took down 968 inauthentic accounts that the Russian government created after its attack on Ukraine began in 2022. In affidavits released with the announcement, officials with the Justice Department, the FBI, and the Pentagon's Cyber National Mission Force linked the effort to Russia's Federal Security Service and RT, the state television network that has channels in English and several other languages. The disclosure of such a large global network of bots confirmed widespread warnings that the popularization of rapidly developing AI tools would make it easier to produce and spread dubious content. With AI, information campaigns can be created in a matter of minutes, the kind of work that in the months before the 2016 presidential election, for example, required an army of office workers. The Russian network used an AI-enhanced software package to create scores of fictitious user profiles on X. And our last article of this segment, Britain's big plans for clean power face challenges on road ahead. There may be no better place to see proof of Britain's shift to cleaner energy than a sleek industrial complex on the Humber Estuary outside Hull, a faded port city. On a July morning, workers in a brightly lit building were preparing molds for fiberglass wind turbine blades longer than football fields. Outside on the docks, squat, six-wheeled vehicles gingerly maneuvered a blade weighing 50 metric tons for loading onto a ship that would take it to Scotland for installation. The factory, which is operated by Siemens Gamesa, a unit of the German company Siemens Energy, began producing the massive blades in 2016. It has since expanded for larger models. The factory is a case study for how the new British government under Prime Minister Keir Starmer, whose Labour Party delivered a decisive election victory last week, hopes to use investment in clean energy to bolster stagnant economic growth. Andy Sykes, the manager of the factory, said that £500 million, or about $630 million, had already been invested in the plant, which employs 1,300 people in an area that has struggled economically for decades. Another round of expansion is in the works. The plant also serves as an anchor for green efforts in the region, one of Britain's major industrial areas, which is dominated by oil refineries and other polluters. Mr. Sykes, though, said the British government would need to attract the funding for port expansion and other efforts to keep the offshore wind industry growing. Now we'll take a brief break, and we'll be back this time with news from the Hartford Courant.
Hi, I am Wendy, a Chris Radio volunteer. Chris wants to share information with you on a very important topic, domestic violence. Domestic violence is a pattern of controlling and abusive behavior. The abuse can be physical, emotional, or psychological. It can be sexual, financial, or technological. It is important that you know that domestic violence is never okay. It is never your fault. And you are not alone. Our friends at Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence and their 18 domestic violence organizations can help you. If you are a victim of domestic violence, please call their toll-free number 888-774-2900. a certified domestic violence counselor, will talk to you about staying safe and will also share information on domestic violence services. Your call is confidential. Again, the number for Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence is 888-774-2900.
This is from the Hartford Courant, the front pages of the Hartford Courant. Disabled man bumped from theater seat. Stefan Byrne, 33, may have a rare genetic disorder, but he can do a lot: kayaking, canoeing, baking, and especially going to concerts. He loves going to concerts and shows, everything that a typical child would do, said his father, David Byrne. The sky's the limit for Stefan. Stefan Byrne has Angelman syndrome, caused by a chromosomal abnormality. It's marked by developmental and motor delays and seizures. Those with the syndrome often have a happy demeanor, according to the Angelman Syndrome Foundation. Byrne is mostly nonverbal, but he was excited to see the children's singer Raffi at the Bushnell Performing Arts Center on May 18th. He and his parents, Roberta and David Byrne of Berlin, had front row seats, partly because Stefan also has a vision impairment. While children were excitedly screaming, waiting for the show to begin, Stefan Byrne was saying hi to the stage crew. Then the unexpected happened. A few minutes before the show was to start, a person from the Bushnell security comes over to my wife and myself, and she sort of whispers, "Can I talk to you?" David Byrne said. And she said that we need to move you to the back. The artist could hear you in his dressing room and will not perform if you stay in these seats, he said. Basically, they were moving us to the back of the theater. We didn't say anything, Roberta Byrne said. We were absolutely in shock and just didn't know what was going on. Bushnell Security was not only moving them to the back, but to the far right rear seats of the theater, she said. Stefan Byrne was so upset he wouldn't move. Roberta Byrne said she couldn't even think to say anything to the security guard. He's very emotionally intelligent, so he knew what was going on, David Byrne said. He didn't want to have to move, so first we tried to get up and walk towards the back, and he wanted nothing to do with that. And he's a big guy, so I then asked the security people if they could bring a wheelchair so we can at least get him to sit in a wheelchair, which they were somehow able to do. Stefan Byrne resisted that as well, so his parents wheeled him away quickly so they wouldn't disrupt the show. Stefan Byrne was so upset, and it was clear he wouldn't have been able to enjoy the show, so his parents decided to leave the theater altogether. My son was too upset, and we had to take care of him, Roberta Byrne said. The Byrnes said neither Raffi nor the Bushnell reached out to them afterward. Finally, Roberta Byrne called the Bushnell and got an apology and a refund for their tickets. And there's quite a bit more to this story. Not pleasant, but we don't have time to read it all. Mayor tackles school problems. Hartford leader wants group to review poverty, low scores, underfunding. With systemic challenges such as poverty and chronic underfunding plaguing Hartford Public Schools, the city's mayor has created a new commission on education charged with finding solutions. Mayor Arunan Arulampalam announced the creation of Hartford's Blue Ribbon Commission on Education Wednesday afternoon. The commission will be led by a group of three co-chairs, including Andrea Comer, Chief of Staff to State Treasurer Eric Russell, Hector Rivera, President and CEO at Our Piece of the Pie, and Dr. Catherine Carbone, former Superintendent of Bristol Public Schools. The co-chairs will directly oversee a 10-member steering committee. Steering committee members include a diverse array of local and state leaders, including State Representative Joshua Hall, Deputy Speaker and Assistant Principal Weaver High School, State Representative Jeff Curry, co-chair of the Legislative Education Committee, Hartford City Council member Amilcar Hernandez, Marlene Ibsen, CEO and President, Travelers Foundation, Jen Hockenhall, Chair of the Hartford Board of Education, Corey Moses, Vice President of the Hartford Federation of Teachers, Dr. Condra Ratley, Chief Academic Officer, Hartford Public Schools, and an unnamed Hartford parent representative. The group will meet regularly over the next 6 months to gather ideas ahead of the next legislative session. We all share a commitment to the boundless potential within each and every child in our school system, Arulam Palam said. I carry this commitment not only as a mayor, but also as an advocate and a father. We have heard the concerns from parents and teachers alike, and my administration is taking tangible steps to set our system up to move forward in the years ahead. This commission represents unprecedented collaboration between the state, the city, the Board of Education, teachers, parents, and our corporate community to build a stronger future for our children. The new commission comes after a year fraught with challenges for the district. In January, the district announced an unprecedented $77 million deficit with finger pointing between city and school officials for the fiscal crisis. 4.5% raises kick in for state workers. Connecticut has withheld more than $7.5 billion from core state programs since 2022 to pay down pension debt and build reserves, a total that exceeds 30% of the entire general fund. But even as advocates for education, health care, and other core programs have heard officials say government must prioritize fiscal health, they've watched over the same 3 years as 40,000-plus state employees have enjoyed, on average, 4.5% annual raises that often outpace the private sector and sometimes inflation. As Connecticut began a new fiscal year 2 weeks ago, projecting to save another $1.2 billion to beef up its finances, state workers are receiving their fourth straight 4.5% hike. That includes a 2.5% general increase and a step hike, which typically adds 2 percentage points of value for all but the most senior workers. Since the budget controls were enacted in 2017, one provision alone has barred legislators from spending more than $9.5 billion in state tax revenues on core services or on anything else, on the grounds that these revenues were unstable. Analysts say this volatility adjustment savings program will keep grabbing big dollars, at least $800 million per year through 2028. But collective bargaining rules allow unions to cite these receipts and allow arbitrators to consider them when calculating whether the state can afford to pay healthy raises. Some say that distinction and its potential consequences were unanticipated when the guardrails were crafted 7 years ago. State employees benefit from their pensions becoming more solvent as debt is paid down, said House Minority Leader Vincent Jay, a Republican from North Branford. And at the front end of the budget process, they're eating at the trough first. While some legislators want to revise the budget controls, saving less and making more available for core programs, others say it's time to change collective bargaining rules and clamp down on pay hikes. Evacuation of Gaza City pressed by Israel military. The Israeli military urged all Palestinians to leave Gaza City and head south Wednesday, pressing ahead with a fresh offensive across the north, south, and center of the embattled territory that has killed dozens of people over the past 48 hours. The stepped-up military activity came as U.S., Egyptian, and Qatari mediators met with Israeli officials in the Qatari capital, Doha, for talks seeking a long, elusive ceasefire deal with Gaza's Hamas in exchange for the release of dozens of Israeli hostages it is holding. Israel says it is pursuing Hamas fighters that are regrouping in various parts of Gaza 9 months into the war. But heavy strikes in recent days along the length of the territory also could be aimed at putting more pressure on Hamas in the ceasefire talks. In a visit Wednesday to central Gaza, Israel's military chief, Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, said forces were operating in different ways in multiple parts of the territory to carry out a very important mission, pressure. We will continue operating to bring home the hostages. Israel informed people in Gaza of the evacuation order by dropping leaflets urging all those in Gaza City to take two safe routes south to the safe routes being in quotes south to the area around the central city of Deir al-Balah. Gaza City, it said, will remain a dangerous combat zone. Months ago, Israel ordered residents of northern Gaza, including Gaza City, to flee south, and much of the population left earlier in the war. Large parts of Gaza City and urban areas around it have been flattened or left a shattered landscape by previous Israeli assaults. The United Nations says about 300,000 Palestinians have remained in the hard-hit north, with the bulk of those said to be in Gaza City. Most of Gaza's 2.3 million people are crammed into squalid tent camps in central and southern Gaza. Israeli troops have pushed into parts of Gaza City in recent days, triggering the flight of thousands of Palestinians trying to escape shelling and airstrikes. And our last article before the break, GOP House okays bill on proof of citizenship for voter registration. The U.S. House of Representatives on Wednesday passed a proof of citizenship requirement for voter registration, a proposal Republicans have prioritized as an election year talking point, even as research shows non-citizens illegally registering and casting ballots in federal elections is exceptionally rare. The legislation, approved largely along partisan lines, but with five Democrats voting in favor, is unlikely to advance through the Democratic-led Senate. The Biden administration also says it's strongly opposed because it says safeguards already are in place to verify voter eligibility and enforce the law against non-citizen voting. Still, the House vote will give Republicans an opportunity to focus on two of their key issues, border and election security. It also provides an opportunity to fuel former President Donald Trump's claims that Democrats have encouraged the surge of migrants so they can register them to vote, which would be illegal. Non-citizens are not allowed to vote in federal elections, nor allowed to vote in any statewide elections. Research and audits show there have been incidences of non-citizens who successfully register to vote and cast ballots, but it happens rarely and is typically by mistake. States have mechanisms to check for it, but there isn't one standard protocol they all follow. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, a key backer of the bill, said in a news conference earlier this week that the Democratic opposition means many Democrats, quote, want illegals to participate in our federal elections. They want them to vote, end quote. And now we'll take a brief break and we'll return with our last segment of today's Front Pages.
An organization known for its service to blinded veterans, helping them adjust to life without sight, attracts extraordinary members who are dedicated to serving one another. The Blinded Veterans Association, or BVA, has members in 52 regional groups nationwide who work to make life better for one another. One such example is Roy Young of Trinity, Texas, a member of the Greater Houston Regional Group and a longtime president of that group. A Vietnam veteran who enlisted in the Army at age 17, he was discharged 4 years later, having reached the rank of Sergeant E5. Young ultimately lost his sight due to complications from diabetes and glaucoma and sought help through VA blind rehabilitation. Today he serves on the BVA National Board of Directors Young and BVA are actively searching for vets who may have never heard of the organization and the rehabilitation services available to them through the Department of Veterans Affairs. For more information, call 800-669-7079 or visit bva.org.
And we're back, this time with news from the Connecticut section of the Hartford Courant. State police charge second suspect in stabbing. A Willimantic woman was extradited to Connecticut on Monday to face charges in a non-fatal stabbing in Thompson in May, in which she allegedly assaulted a woman at the direction of an alleged drug dealer and left her bleeding at a boat launch. Cassandra Heredia, 31, faces charges of first-degree assault, conspiracy to commit first-degree assault, and third-degree assault, according to Connecticut State Police. She was arrested on June 12th in Bangor, Maine, after authorities there learned she had a warrant out for her arrest in connection with the stabbing and has been held in custody since. State police said Heredia was held on a $175,000 bond and was expected to appear Tuesday in Danielson Superior Court following her extradition. According to the arrest warrant affidavit, the victim was in a black Ford with Heredia and an unknown man who was driving on May 10th for an alleged drug deal involving crack cocaine. The woman said she had been picked up before the trio made multiple stops and ultimately stopped at a boat launch in Thompson. At the boat launch, the victim alleged that Heredia, who she described as an acquaintance, punched her multiple times in the face, the warrant affidavit said. Heredia then got on a video call with Lawson, who the victim alleged had assaulted her about a week prior after he accused her of stealing drugs from him, according to the warrant affidavit. During the video call, Heredia allegedly told Lawson that she, quote, beat the, an expletive, out of her and asked what he wanted her to do, the warrant affidavit said. The victim told investigators Heredia then allegedly attacked her again and stabbed her in the leg three times, according to the warrant affidavit. The victim alleged Heredia was acting under Lawson's direction. The victim said she was able to call 911 during the attack. And let's see. Watchdog panel told to wait for approval. An appointee of Governor Ned Lamont is proposing that Connecticut's contracting watchdog panel not publicly discuss its work, which includes investigations of executive branch agencies, without clearing it with him. But Gregory F. Daniels, appointed by Governor Ned Lamont as executive director of the State Contracting Standards Board, said Monday that the draft ethics policy he and other staff submitted to members last week is to ensure, quote, consistent and transparent disclosure, end quote, and not to restrict communications. Lamont spokeswoman Julia Bergman said the governor's office was not aware of the language that was included in the draft, which will be taken up by the board later this week. Members and staff of the watchdog agency, who are empowered to review contracts and purchasing rules for all agencies, are, quote, expected and encouraged to discuss the organization with one another, end quote, reads the draft policy. But they shall not report opinions expressed in meetings, nor shall they report independently on the SCSB board or committee actions, or engage in any communication that has not been approved by the executive director or that would not be supported by SCSB board policy, procedures, or decisions. That's all in quotes. It further stipulates. It sounds like a gag order, said board member Salvatore Luciano, former head of the Connecticut AFL-CIO, who added it seemingly reverses the roles of the board and the executive director appointed to serve it. The executive director reports to the board, Luciano said. This would have the board report to him. It makes absolutely no sense. Board member Daniel Rovero, a former state representative from Killingly, noted the draft seemingly blocks members from discussing business, even matters discussed in open session at board meetings, which can be accessed by the public without Daniel's approval. Rovero added he would reserve judgment until the board discusses the draft with Daniels when it meets at 10 a.m. Friday at the State Office Building at 165 Capitol Avenue in Hartford. But at first blush, he said, it doesn't sound right. Anything that's discussed in open session, you should be able to discuss it with anybody. The contracting board, which grew out of the scandal that ultimately sent former Governor John G. Rowland to federal prison, performs sensitive work. Social Equity Council Director Handling Cannabis Cash resigns. Ginny Ray Clay has resigned as the executive director of the Social Equity Council, an agency that oversees elements of Connecticut's cannabis industry and is the subject of an audit requested by Governor Ned Lamont. Regrettably, my final days in this role have been marred by unsubstantiated allegations, threats, and publicly leaked false narratives, all of which have unjustly called my character and integrity into question, she wrote in her resignation. Clay offered no specifics, but the Connecticut Mirror reported 2 weeks ago that the council's chair, Andrea Comer, received a complaint that Clay suggested that a licensed applicant make a donation to the church she attends. Clay denied the allegation. Clay could not be reached for comment, but an ally on the council, Mike Jefferson of New Haven, defended her. It's a sad day for me. I think she was a victim of a personal vendetta and personal infighting, Jefferson said. It's unfortunate because I think she was a very competent executive director, very intelligent and very hardworking, and most importantly, I think, she was very compassionate about what was needed for Black and Brown communities across this state. Comer was not alone in questioning Clay's management and what the governor's legal counsel and others complained was the absence of a strategy in the first distribution of social equity funds raised by cannabis licenses. For me, there is nothing personal, Comer said. I think she has made the decision to resign from her position. I think she has made the decision to resign from her position. Second, there have been many conversations among the council members about challenges within the SEC and the way in which we need to course correct. The SEC is the acronym for the Social Equity Council. The $5.2 million in the initial 162 community reinvestment grants authorized last year was sprinkled among scores of churches, youth programs, and other nonprofits in census tracts deemed to be, quote, disproportionately impacted areas, end quote, or DIAs, as measured by poverty and residents convicted of drug crimes. Clay's church received a $15,000 grant, though the grant was made by one of the independent nonprofits contracted to evaluate applications. Further distributions were suspended after the legislature's Black and Puerto Rican caucus objected to the lack of an overall plan. And our last article this morning, Trakonis pleads not guilty to contempt charge. Michelle Trakonis pleaded not guilty on Wednesday to a contempt of court charge stemming from the trial earlier this year that led to her being found guilty of multiple conspiracy and tampering charges in the 2019 disappearance and death of Jennifer Farber Deloce. Trakonis, 49, entered the not guilty plea during a brief hearing in Stamford Superior Court, where her case was continued to September 16th, according to the clerk's office. Trakonis has been accused of displaying a sealed custody report on her laptop during her trial earlier this year in the death of Farber Deloce. Carrie Luft, a friend of Farber Deloce and spokesperson for the Farber family, allegedly saw the sealed report and alerted prosecutors to it. The criminal contempt of court charge Traconis faces is a misdemeanor that carries a maximum of 6 months in jail. Traconis was sentenced to 14 and a half years in prison, followed by 5 years of probation in May, after a jury found her guilty of conspiracy to commit murder, conspiracy to commit tampering with evidence, second-degree hindering prosecution, and 2 counts of tampering with evidence. During the trial, prosecutors showed video surveillance footage of Traconis' then-boyfriend, Fotis Delos, dumping evidence tied to Farber Delos on Albany Avenue in Hartford. Prosecutors also played for the jury video and audio from Traconis' multiple interviews with police, during which authorities allege she was untruthful about Farber Delos' disappearance in May 2019. And that ends the news segment of our show this morning. But we do have some birthdays and some almanac items. So birthdays, today being July 11th, fashion designer Giorgio Armani is 90. Actor Celia Ward is 68. Actor Mark Lester is 66. Singer Suzanne Vega is 65. Rock guitarist Richie Sambora of Bon Jovi is 65. Actor Lisa Rinna is 61. Author Humpa Lahiri is 57. Wildlife expert Jeff Corwin is 57. Rapper Lil' Kim is 50. U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona is 49. Pro Football Hall of Famer Andre Johnson is 43. And tennis player Caroline Wozniacki is 34. Now, today in history, these are some almanac items for you. Today is Thursday, July 11th, the 193rd day of 2024. There are 173 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history, on July 11th, 1995, the UN-designated safe haven of Srebrenica in Bosnia-Herzegovina fell to Bosnian Serb forces, who subsequently carried out the killings of more than 8,000 Muslim men and boys. Now, also on this date, July 11th, in 1798, the U.S. Marine Corps was formally reestablished by a congressional act that also created the U.S. Marine Band. In 1804, Vice President Aaron Burr mortally wounded former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton during a pistol duel in Weehawken, New Jersey. Hamilton died the next day. In 1859, Big Ben, the great bell inside the famous London clock tower, chimed for the first time. In 1914, Babe Ruth made his Major League Baseball debut, pitching the Boston Red Sox to a 4-3 victory over Cleveland. In 1960, Harper Lee's novel To Kill a Mockingbird was published. And in 2022, President Joe Biden revealed the first image from NASA's new space telescope, the farthest humanity had ever seen in both time and distance, closer to the dawn of the universe and the edge of the cosmos. We will end this edition of the Front Pages. I've been reading from today's New York Times and Hartford Current. My name is Lodia Vola. If you missed any part of the program, it is repeated this evening at 6 and 11, and it's available anytime on our telephone reader service and on demand at our website, chrisradio.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.